example, in which people do the selecting. The things that are not good at sticking around eventually disappear through entropy, the tendency of things to randomize and level out over time, like sandcastles on a beach or a decaying log. Evolution is a scientific model of how things become more complex. Entropy describes how things become simpler. They are the creative and the destructive forces of the universe. The two forces operate not only in the physical universe, but also in the realm of the mind. The study of evolution is the study of making copies. A replicator is anything that gets copied. Sometimes a replicator seems to do more than just get copied passively. It seems to take a more active role. Perhaps it could be said to make copies of itself. The difference is merely a matter of point of view. Sometimes it will seem more natural to think of a replicator as making copies of itself, as when cells split and DNA duplicates. At other times, it will make more sense to think of a replicator as something that just happens to get copied, as when people hum a catchy tune or the idea of democracy spreads throughout the world. In all cases, the copying happens, which is what evolution needs. Anything at all that gets copied, no matter what the copying mechanism, and whether or not there is a conscious intention to copy, is a replicator. Sometimes mistakes get made in copying. That's necessary for evolution to take place. If the fidelity of the copies is too high, nothing ever changes. If it's too low, you don't really have a replicator. Soon the quality that made the thing good at replicating will be lost, just as a copy of a copy of a copy of an office memorandum becomes illegible. Evolution requires two things: replication with a certain degree of fidelity, and innovation or a certain degree of infidelity. Of course, if only one or two copies ever get made of a replicator, it's not a particularly interesting one for the purpose of understanding evolution. We're interested in replicators that produce enough high-fidelity copies of themselves that those copies in turn become replicators, and the resultant exponential growth quickly produces a large number of copies. When we talk about survival of the fittest, we mean survival of the thing that's best at replicating. In evolution, fitness means the likelihood of being copied. The fitter something is, the greater its chances of being copied. The word fit in our model of how evolution works means nothing more than that. There is no connotation of strength, agility, longevity, or extraordinary intelligence. If a replicator is fit, it's good at replicating. That's all. It's tempting to think that a durable, long-lived replicator might compete successfully against a shorter-lived one that's better at being copied, but mathematics shows that this is not the case. The fittest replicators make the most copies of themselves and therefore become more abundant than the rest. Survival of the fittest is just a bit misleading. It's more like abundance of the fittest. Of course, if resources are scarce, the gain of the fittest replicators is at the expense of those less fit. All this brings us to Dawkins's selfish gene. The selfish gene theory, in one flash of insight, answered so many sticky questions and puzzling details of evolution that it paralleled the astronomical discovery that the Earth was not the center of the universe. While Dawkins popularized the selfish gene theory in the same 1976 book in which he introduced the word meme, credit for the first publication of the idea goes to British biologist William D. Hamilton in 1963. Prior to Hamilton's work, most scientists had assumed evolution revolved around us, or individuals, of whatever species we're discussing. The Darwinian idea was that evolution proceeded by the fittest individuals surviving and reproducing more individuals like themselves. Darwin's brilliant insight, the theory of evolution by natural selection, explained the facts well enough that it held on for a long time. But Darwin had never heard of DNA. The selfish gene theory shifted the evolutionary spotlight from the fittest individuals onto the fittest DNA. After all, it's the DNA that carries the information passed from one generation to the next, not whole individuals. Those pieces of DNA that play this game, causing themselves to be replicated by whatever means, are called genes. The fact that evolution seems to revolve around their well-being rather than ours makes them selfish genes. All of biological evolution has been a contest between pieces of DNA to to see which genes could make the most copies of themselves. From a gene's point of view, a human being is just a way of making more genes. The trick to understanding genetic evolution, then, is to look at it from the point of view of the pieces of DNA competing for replication. Before we leave the topic of genetic evolution, let's look at one question. What exactly is evolution evolving toward? Most of us who've taken high school biology assume that evolution is guiding us to be fitter and fitter human beings, and steadily improving the quality of life on Earth and in the universe. As time goes by, we complacently assume the fittest of us will survive, reproduce, and create a bigger, better, and stronger human race. Perhaps evolution will favor greater and greater intellect, or even greater and greater contributions to the world. Genetic evolution favors the replication of the fittest DNA. And by fittest, I mean the best at getting replicated. So as long as we're good soldiers for DNA replicators and keep multiplying and expanding, genetic evolution will favor us. But it also favors insects, which vastly outnumber us, and of course, viruses, which parasitically insert themselves into whatever replication mechanism they can find, such as us, and do quite well at it. Whether we're winning, or the insects are, or the viruses are, is simply a matter of frame of reference. It's the DNA that's evolving, and we simply play a part in it. Evolution of genes or memes reflects the haphazard and baroque result of an ongoing struggle, not the product of brilliantly engineered design. What's the difference between evolution and engineering? Engineering is the designing of a whole out of parts suited to their individual purposes. Evolution is the process of tiny incremental changes, each making some small or large improvement in the ability of the thing to survive and reproduce. A good engineer avoids something called a kludge, which is jargon for the use of a part not particularly suited to its purpose. But evolution favors, even cherishes, the kludge. Suddenly finding a new purpose for a part without significantly diminishing its old function is a staple of the evolutionary process. A classic example of an evolutionary kludge is the human eye. The nerves that connect the light-sensing cells to the brain actually come out of the front of the retina rather than the back. The wiring protrudes out into the eye's field of vision. It's difficult to imagine an engineer, let alone God, designing something this way. But evolution took what it had to work with and, kludge by kludge, built an eye. You can imagine a primitive creature having a light-sensing cell that evolved over millions of years into a better and better source of vision. Back when the light-sensing cell was simple, there was no advantage in having it oriented one way or the other. By the time it had developed through kludges into a complex eye with a focusing lens, there was no way to redesign it so the wires would come out the back. It's the kludgy nature of evolution that makes it so difficult to decipher DNA. If DNA worked as a computer program, with its billions of lines of code divided neatly into functions and subroutines, we would have reverse engineered it by now. Politicians would be vying for votes based on their views on the morality of our producing genetically engineered creatures from scratch. If DNA worked like that, genetic engineers could design, and presumably patent or copyright, any animal or organism they can envision. Fortunately or not, the moral debate over such manufactured bio-appliances seems still quite a few years in the future. That's because DNA and evolution don't work like a software engineer writing a computer program. DNA evolves by mutation, by little pieces of it reversing, crossing over, inserting in one place, deleting from another place, resulting in some small or large difference in the development of the embryo and finally the full-grown organism. But with minor exceptions, there's no one-to-one connection between any particular piece of DNA and a particular piece of the resultant adult organism. The DNA is not a blueprint, contrary to a popular metaphor. There's no place in the human DNA that represents the right index finger or the left little toenail. True, scientists have found a few stretches of human DNA that, to the degree they differ between individuals, seem to map to corresponding changes in the individual's appearance, such as eye color, blood type, or susceptibility to various diseases. But the number of these stretches is minuscule compared to the total amount of human DNA. Scientists seem to be coming to the conclusion that there are huge strings of genetic material in humans that appear to have no effect whatsoever on their host. If we look at DNA as an animal's means of reproducing itself, it makes no sense to have vast stretches of DNA that don't do anything. It's just excess baggage. From the DNA's point of view, however, it makes perfect sense. From the point of view of genetic material, the human being that results from the presence of DNA in male and female sex cells is simply the most effective way nature has found of producing more of the same. The DNA makes use of the safety of the mother's womb to manufacture cell after cell containing copies of itself, and finally a new individual ready to go forth and help the DNA multiply yet again. From the DNA's point of view, having copies of itself is our whole point for existing. Keep in mind that species evolved as a result of the fittest, best at replicating, DNA being selected and copied, over and over and over again over millions of years. Other than our intellectual fascination with it, genetic evolution has little effect on our everyday lives. Worrying about genetic evolution is a little like worrying about being run over by a glacier. Unless you're planning to stand still for the next few thousand years, it's just not going to have much impact. Neither your DNA nor mine will evolve during our lifetimes. It's the end of the DNA era, but it's not the end of the story. For us, it's just the beginning. Humans seem to have reached a higher stage of evolution. What I mean is that our minds, lives, and cultures are affected by the evolution of something besides DNA. Because while genetic evolution happens so slowly that it even takes a leap of faith to believe in it, there's a new kind of evolution happening so fast that it leaves DNA in the Darwinian dust. It's the evolution of something even nearer and dearer to us than DNA. Until a few thousand years ago, DNA was the foremost method in the known universe for storing and replicating information. That's why you can't talk about evolution without talking about DNA. Evolution is about the replication of information, and almost all the information on Earth was stored in DNA. Today we have another medium for storing information, one that replicates, mutates, and propagates far faster than DNA. We have a medium so effective at evolution that new replicators can be created, tried, and spread wildly, all in days or even hours, as compared to thousands of years for DNA. The new medium is so much more interesting and important than DNA to our daily lives that genetic evolution is virtually non-existent by comparison. What is the name of this new, ripe, prolific medium for evolution? It's called the mind, and the replicator that evolves in our minds is called the meme. Chapter 5. The Evolution of Memes. Once our brains evolved to the point where we could receive, store, modify, and communicate ideas, there suddenly appeared a new environment that had the two characteristics needed for evolution, copying and innovating. Our brains, which arose out of increasing usefulness in the process of keeping us alive and breeding, suddenly were thrust into the spotlight of evolution. The brand new innovation of the human mind was not just another arena for evolution besides the cell, it was a far better arena, simply because evolution takes place far more quickly. The biological forces that evolved our brains to the point where we had minds were now outdone a million times over by the new mimetic forces evolving our thoughts, our society, and our culture. Evolution of the meme was assured. Meme evolution happens because our minds are good at copying and innovating. Ideas, behaviors, tunes, shapes, structures, and so on. We evolved genetically to the point where we had minds because of a selfish gene for minds, or for some precursor of minds that gave people with that gene a survival advantage. With that advantage, we survive and multiply, replicating the selfish gene for minds. The DNA that causes us to have minds is, of course, not quite as fit as the DNA that makes insects small, fast, and hard-shelled. There are far more insects than people, and we're not even that good at winning battles with insects over who gets to live where. But our minds are certainly an advantage to us, and therefore to our host DNA. From the DNA's point of view, of course, we're still here for one reason only: to go forth and multiply. But the DNA's only way to achieve its purpose is through the glacially slow process of genetic evolution, one step every 20 years or so, compared with the breakneck pace of meme evolution, in which an idea mutates in the time it takes to read a sentence. Because mimetic evolution happens so much faster, most of what we do with our brains has little to do with genetic evolution. Being a genius, advancing the state of science or technology, creating art, writing plays, all of these are kludgy uses of our brain, layered on top of the uses that made brainy people go forth and multiply. I'm not saying we can completely ignore genes from now on. There have been alarming reports of the lowering of the general intelligence level because smart people have fewer babies. If there are any genes that give people the tendency to take on memes that limit their number of offspring, they will die out in a few generations in favor of competing genes that give people a tendency to acquire childbearing memes. So making a note to keep an eye on our mental rearview mirror to check on the progress of genetic evolution every once in a while, let's shift into the fast lane for the rest of the book and run with the memes. The mechanism of evolution has no purpose in itself. It is simply the inexorable battle of replicators for access to whatever replication mechanisms are available. The evolution of ideas, culture, and society revolves around the selfish meme, just as the evolution of species revolves around the selfish gene. Again, this is not the truth, just a useful model. And viewing life in this way may be a big pill to swallow. After all, we're used to thinking of ourselves as brilliant, free-thinking individuals, not players in the memes game. But it's a pill that relieves much of the headache of understanding how culture works. From a meme's point of view, our minds exist for the sole purposes of making copies of the meme. I'm not saying a meme has a point of view, just that if it did have one, that's what it would be. The selfish meme is just as selfish as the selfish gene, and the concept is just as void of any literal meaning. The purpose of looking at the world from the point of view of mindless replicators is that it brings a great deal of clarity to a confusing situation. So from a meme's point of view, not only our minds and brains, but also our whole bodies, cities, countries, and certainly television sets, exist for that same selfish purpose. That's important to understand. If television sets did not aid in copying memes, we would have no television sets. They certainly didn't evolve biologically. The most popular and prevalent parts of our culture are the most effective at copying memes. Every part of our culture, beyond what we see in animal cultures, and maybe even that, is a product of meme evolution. The most popular ideas are the ones that spread the easiest. The most popular art is the art with the fittest memes. Television is a crucible for meme evolution. Shows that don't attract repeat viewers or word-of-mouth recommendations die quickly, replaced by an endless supply of mutations and variations. Ideas for running your business, managing your finances, and improving your life become prevalent not because they're the best for you, but because they are the best at spreading. The two are sometimes related, but often not. We have many ways to spread memes. Speech, writing, body language, monkey see, monkey do, television. But why do some memes, such as the proverbial bad news, travel fast, while other memes, such as the ones in unpopular TV shows, die quickly? We can start to get an answer to that question by speculating about back when genetic evolution had more influence upon the contents of our brains than meme evolution did. Initially, the only purpose of our brains was to help our DNA make copies of itself. The chief way we helped it do that is by surviving, mating with other people who shared most of that DNA, and having as many children as possible live to reproduce. Our brains made us better at pursuing the four basic drives that animals have, fondly referred to by zoologists as the four Fs: fighting, fleeing, feeding, and finding a mate. Memes build on these basic brain functions. These brain functions are part of the hardware design for the software called memes. As animals evolved, those that had a superior ability to communicate certain information tended to survive and reproduce better than the others. Back to the four Fs: information about danger, about the location of food, and about the fact that they are ready to mate. Communication evolved in order to communicate very specific things: danger, food, and sex. Therefore, we, as the product of evolution of animals, find ourselves with the tendency both to talk about and to pay attention to danger, food, and sex in preference to other subjects. Memes involving danger, food, and sex spread faster than other memes because we are wired to pay more attention to them. We have buttons around those subjects. It would be a challenge to find any culture or subculture on Earth today that did not concern itself with crises, missions, problems, dangers, or opportunities. Let's run a quick check to see if we spend an inordinate amount of our communication bandwidth on those subjects, sprinkled in with our danger, food, and sex. Flip through a few channels on your TV. Leaf through a few pages of your daily newspaper. The national fiction bestseller list is populated with thrillers and love stories, and the nonfiction list has books about deadly diseases, improving your sex life, eating better food, and political crises, with only the occasional self-improvement book to offer a twinkle of hope. And people probably only read those because they're scared of the danger they'll encounter if they don't. I always thought the book The Doctor's Quick Weight Loss Diet must have sold a million copies on the memes and the title alone. What an opportunity to have someone you trust address the problem of your sex appeal crisis over food! To illustrate the effectiveness of the crisis, mission, problem, danger, and opportunity memes, listen to the following two paragraphs, both accurate descriptions of a book about memes. This first paragraph doesn't have these memes in it. Introduction to Memetics is a compilation of ideas on the science of memetics. Each chapter summarizes a different topic in this field. Included are examples of how memetics impacts people's lives, illustrates historical data, and offers choices for the future. The second is chock full of all five of these key memes. Virus of the mind exposes the imminent crisis of the dangerous new technology known as memetics. What is it, and how can we guard against its harmful effects? Our only chance is to have everyone read Virus of the Mind before it's too late. A common reaction would be to fall asleep halfway through the first paragraph and to pay much more attention to the second. You have little control over that tendency. Your brain is hardwired to respond that way. You may have noticed some skepticism kicking in while listening to the second paragraph. The skepticism strategy meme protects the existing set of memes your mind is holding to some degree. Unfortunately, it resists beneficial and harmful new memes equally. Now it gets more complicated, so hold on tight. Remember, our brains were not engineered for a specific purpose. They were kludged together by natural selection, different things being tried out, strengthened, weakened, and combined, until something interesting happened that caused the genes responsible for that thing to replicate better than the others. That's how our brains and those of other animals evolved to pay close attention to information involving danger, food, and sex. Our brains have a natural tendency to pay attention to some other things, too. Laughter and yawning, for instance, are both contagious. Our brains tend to replicate them when they're around. But most of the things to which our brains are attentive evolved in order to support our survival and reproduction. The complexity comes because genetic evolution didn't just stop at the point where we were equipped to notice a tiger running toward us, a ready-to-eat meal, or an eyelash-batting member of the opposite sex. Evolution naturally progressed to select for a diversity of clever, sneaky, and indirect ways of avoiding danger, finding food, and wooing mates. All animals have four basic instinctual drives: fighting, fleeing, feeding, and mating. So in addition to paying attention to danger, food, and sex, our brains come equipped with two ways of dealing with danger, and one each for food and sex, with no conscious thought necessary. These drives work by firing up appropriate parts of our brains, which, if we don't consciously intervene, will drive us to satisfy the need. Even if we do consciously refrain from acting on impulse, we can feel this all going on quite easily, and in fact have names for the distinct feelings that go along with the drives to fight, flee, feed, and mate: anger, fear, hunger, and lust. These four feelings are wired so directly into our brains that, civilized though we may get, we experience from time to time someone or something pushing our buttons, saying or doing something that generates one of these basic feelings in us. It's very difficult to avoid paying attention when it happens, and where there's attention, there are memes. The idea of paying attention plays a central role in understanding memes. A meme that lots of people pay attention to will be more successful than a meme that few notice. So over the millions of years necessary for major genetic evolution to take place, we aren't surprised to find that most animals, including ourselves, have a genetic tendency to pay attention to the things that were important in getting us where we are today: danger, food, and sex. In our search for mind viruses, then, our first candidates will be situations that push one or more of these four buttons: anger, fear, hunger, and lust, and thus draw our precious attention to a use of our consciousness for which, upon reflection, we would not choose to spend it. Enhanced communication had huge survival value in the evolution of human beings, but the innovation that makes us human is consciousness. It's the same innovation that makes us such a wonderful environment for meme evolution. The deep thoughts we think and the elegant intellectual models we build are all kludged on top of the advanced survival and mating functions of the brain, which in turn are kludged on top of the primitive survival and mating functions: fear, anger, hunger, and lust. Our brains evolved countless secondary strategies to make us better not only at survival and reproduction, but also at satisfying those four first-order urges. Here are a few second-order instinctual drives some people seem to have that are all opportunities for memes to take advantage of. Belonging. Memes that give people a feeling of belonging to a group have an advantage over memes that don't. Distinguishing yourself. Any memes that make people feel distinguished, special, or important have an edge in meme evolution. Caring. Memes that take advantage of people's caring natures have an advantage in the battle for a share of our minds. Approval. Successful memes hook into people's drive to get approval and play on the guilt, shame, and hurt that result if they don't get it. And obeying authority. It was in an individual's genetic interest, in the interest of his or her DNA, to recognize that obeying the authority of someone more powerful increases his DNA's chance of survival and replication, while fighting the authority might get him or her killed or left out in the cold. The way these second-order drives work is similar to the way the primary drives work. You get some kind of good feeling when you're doing the thing that the drive drives you to do, or you get a bad feeling when you're not. People have many secondary drives connected to various strong feelings, and memes that activate these feelings have the evolutionary advantage. We will simply pay more attention to memes that push our buttons because that is our nature. Our tendency to pay special attention to these memes makes them more likely to replicate and become embedded in our culture. Memes that push our primary and secondary buttons have an evolutionary advantage over memes that don't, even if those other memes might be more accurate or more supportive of our quality of life. Remember, quality of life is not what natural selection is about. Quantity of replication is. Just as DNA replicates when the organism it generates survives and reproduces, memes replicate when the behavior they cause attracts attention. Pushing our buttons is a great way to attract attention to a meme, so memes that annoy, seduce, enrage, or scare us tend to become widespread. In addition to the survival-oriented memes that are still with us, there are some more types of memes that don't seem to particularly help or hurt our survival, but by their very nature are fit to spread effectively. Tradition. A strategy meme to continue what was done or believed in the past is automatically self-perpetuating. People infected with tradition memes are programmed to repeat this meme in the future and spread this meme to future generations. Traditions die hard. Evangelism. Any meme that explicitly involves spreading itself to other people has an added advantage over other memes. Evangelism is often combined with the mission meme, making it even more powerful. Then there are the memes that become entrenched in people's minds and are extremely resistant to attack. Faith. Any meme that entails believing in it blindly can never be dislodged from your belief system by any attack or argument. Combined with evangelism, faith makes for a powerful mind virus envelope that can be stuffed with just about any content. Skepticism. Questioning new ideas is a defense against new memes. The opposite of faith, skepticism actually has a very similar effect on the mind programmed with it. Skeptics are resistant to new ideas, just as the faithful are. A faithful and a skeptic can argue forever and never learn anything. Other memes are fit because of the nature of communication. Imagine a group of people playing the game of telephone. One player starts by whispering a sentence in the next player's ear. That player whispers whatever she hears to the next player, who continues the process until the message, usually garbled beyond recognition, finally makes its way back to the originator, who bursts out laughing at the way his message has evolved. This is meme evolution in a microcosm. What kind of memes survive the ordeal? Familiarity. The familiar spreads more quickly than the unfamiliar because people have distinction memes for familiar things already and therefore notice them more. Making sense. Memes that make sense spread more quickly than ones that don't. People are quick to accept flawed explanations that make more sense over more accurate ones that are harder to understand. My favorite example of meme evolution through the universal game of telephone is Emerson's quotation from his essay Self-Reliance, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds." People frequently leave off the first two words, completely changing Emerson's meaning. Emerson's quote points out the danger of falling into the truth trap. The hobgoblin of little minds, what keeps people from making the most of their lives, is allowing the random mimetic programming you got since you were born to direct your life consistent with itself. Understanding mimetics gives you a chance to look inside at what programs you are running, and if you choose, to reprogram yourself powerfully and consciously to point your life in whatever direction you choose. Of course, then you have to look at what programs are governing your evaluation of how you're programmed, at what programs are governing what you think you desire, then at what programs are governing your motives for reprogramming yourself. Soon you find yourself deep into the realm of philosophy. The science of mimetics does not carry with it a value judgment of how you should live your life. It just gives you a lot of power over living it however you choose, consciously. How many of us consciously direct our attention toward whatever's most important to us? I, for one, hate the fact that my attention tends to get sucked in by people and events that push my survive and reproduce buttons, relics of my animal past. Those buttons make me unconsciously waste large portions of my life. The point is that danger, food, and sex are the priorities of your genes, not necessarily your own personal priorities. When you feel your attention being pulled away from what is most important to you by an apparent crisis, the latest and greatest pizza from Domino's, or an attractive passerby, your genes are conspiring to steal your most valuable possession, your consciousness. Ideas are infectious. We catch them from other people's behavior, from the little bits of culture all around us. That's great if the ideas we catch are good ideas, ones that help us with whatever we're up to in life. The problem is, as you've just seen, ideas spread according to how good their memes are, and not so much according to how useful they are in our lives, or even according to how true they are. As nice as it might be to imagine that we're evolving toward a better, more civilized, more compassionate world, what we're really evolving toward is a world full of memes and mind viruses that replicate better. Ever wonder why life can be such a struggle sometimes? There's a fantasy people have that an ideal life would mean just relaxing and doing what comes naturally. Well, I hate to be the one to break the bad news, but what comes naturally is so far removed from our modern life as to be irrelevant. Today, what comes naturally is a horrendous mismatch between the old wiring of our brains for prehistoric times and the completely different challenges and opportunities of the modern world. Our brains are still wired to pay attention to and generate feelings for situations that were important to us in prehistoric times, and important only in the sense that they helped our genes make as many copies of themselves as possible. The ideas that spread the easiest, and therefore pervade society, are the ones that easily penetrate that old Stone Age brain of ours. The whole of science has been a concentrated effort to foil that natural selection of Stone Age ideas by our brains, and instead select ideas that are useful, that work, that are accurate models of reality. But science is way ahead of the rest of culture in that sense. Memes have their own evolutionary path. They do not evolve to support the replication of our genes. Okay, so meme evolution won't automatically contribute to our sex lives or our family size, but at least it will contribute to our survival, won't it? Nope. As we speak, information is finding more and more ways to replicate and survive. Ideas that would once be forgotten without a trace are now available instantly through information retrieval systems. Computers now back themselves up automatically, replicating all the information in themselves. The email chain letter is an early example of a virus hosted by both computers and minds. As computers get smarter, computer-based replicators will become common and start to overtake mind-based memes as the primary repositories and communicators of information. These new replicators could have more influence on the shape of the world than memes do, just as memes overtook DNA as shapers of the global environment. Where is meme evolution taking us? Nirvana? A living hell? Nowhere in particular? Is there anything we can do to direct it? If there is, should we? One key to answering these questions lies in the controversial new field of evolutionary psychology, the study of how and why our minds evolved to be the way they are today. Now let's take a detailed look at the subject that forms the core of evolutionary psychology, and eternally, one of our favorite topics, sex. Chapter 6. Sex, the root of all evolution. The most fascinating discovery of the new field of evolutionary psychology is the central role that sex plays and has played in shaping our modern behavior and culture. Weaving a twisted path connecting Freud, male chauvinism, puritanism, and womanizing, evolutionary psychology explains the complexity and contradiction inherent in human behavior as never before. Remember, evolutionary psychology is about tendencies, predispositions, and historical artifacts of evolution. It may be true that men are from Mars and women are from Venus, but that doesn't mean we have to live there. People are capable of growing in any direction they choose. What you're about to hear is neither a fatalistic preordainment of people's futures nor an excuse for behaving like an animal. It's just interesting to know how we got where we are today. And we got here, every one of us, as the result of successful matings. This is the obvious insight, the seed out of which grows this whole beautiful new theory. You are the result of an unbroken chain spanning thousands of generations of males and females who were all successful at finding a mate. When we look at it that way, is it any wonder that our sex drives are so strong? That people are willing to lie, cheat, and steal for sex? That United States senators risk and lose their careers rather than pass up an opportunity to have sex with a teenage page? That women stay in abusive relationships rather than lose the potential protector of their children? As bad as these decisions seem, if we think about them purely rationally, we make them anyway because of our tremendously strong genetic tendencies relating to sex. Over and over again since the beginning of sexual reproduction, genes that gave people and animals before them a mating edge over their peers were the ones that got passed down. Likewise, natural selection was unforgiving of individuals who, by their choice or destiny, failed to mate successfully. Their DNA died with them. The battle for sex was the prime fighting ground in the war of DNA to copy itself. There are innumerable ways in which DNA can influence its host's success in mating, but the most straightforward is to enhance whatever appeals to the opposite sex, accentuate the positive, and eliminate the negative. Since the most attractive individuals will reproduce more than the rest, we would expect attractiveness to be selected for. Not simply good looks, but every quality that appeals to the opposite sex. As a result of genetic evolution, individuals evolve to be more and more sexually attractive. Though what's true for the human race as a whole is not true for every individual man or woman, although the species may be evolving wondrously, we just get the DNA we're dealt and make do with it. And make do we do. The industries that have sprung up in order to enhance people's sexual attraction are enormous. Fashion, cosmetics, diet programs, and fitness clubs are just a few of the cultural institutions that have emerged to feed people's drive to be more appealing. Short of replacing our current system of reproducing with test tubes and cloning, we're stuck with it. Sexual reproduction is where survival of the fittest gets down to the nitty-gritty. So, like it or not, Many of the genetic tendencies we are born with revolve around sex and mating. Let's take a step back now and see how genetic evolution got us where we are today. This is all speculation, since we don't have much historical data about how people behaved in prehistoric times, but it all falls out from an understanding of the selfish gene concept. Imagine it's the early days of sexual reproduction in animals. Males and females pretty much mate with each other at random, with whomever is convenient. Over the course of time, the genes of the animals that tend to be a bit more discriminating in their choices of mates tend to be a bit more successful in replicating themselves. So animals evolve to be more discriminating. How do they do it? Remember, this is not a conscious process or even a process of ever-improving design. It's a random process of kludge upon kludge. Suppose one species has developed a keen sense of smell as an adaptation against predators. Pretty soon, the species evolves toward using its sense of smell to discern mates. Now suppose it turns out that females have a hormone that males don't have, and there's a discernible odor produced by that hormone for no particular reason, but one that males can smell. The males that tend to use that information to be picky about their mates are more successful than the ones who simply ignore it, and pretty soon the animals evolve to be even more discriminating. This step-by-step, inch-by-inch process continues constantly, the more discerning males having better success at reproduction and therefore filling the gene pool with more copies of their DNA than the others. Okay, let's look at the female end. Now that the gene pool is filled with sniffing connoisseurs of female odors, any females that tend to produce more of that odor have the advantage in attracting mates over the rest. At this point, males will start evolving to pick up on other differences between males and females. Coloration, size, shape, vive la différence. The more discerning males will be more successful, and the females that accentuate those features will also be more successful. This brings us back to where we started the discussion, with individuals evolving to be more and more sexually attractive. This works in the other direction, too. Females can require stricter and stricter standards for their mates so long as they are physically able to resist their advances. It's common among birds to see males with brilliant plumage courting dull females. In these cases, the females evolve to be more discriminating, and the males evolve to have more and more pronounced sex characteristics. It's important to remember that this evolution of sex characteristics is not happening by plan or design, just by the interaction between the chaotic force of random variation and the organizing force of evolution. Evolution harnesses the disorganized movements and changes in the environment to make slow but steady progress through the course of the eons. One way in which evolution happened to make progress was by specializing the roles of males and females, a distinction known as sexual differentiation. Evolutionary psychology shows that there really are significant differences in men's and women's drives and tendencies, in general. When these differences become stereotyped and used as weapons against individuals, we use a less kind term, sexism. The psychological differences between men and women began when mammals evolved to put all their eggs in one basket, so to speak, inside the female. Actually, sexual differentiation started even earlier than that, practically at the origin of sex, when females evolved to produce big, relatively expensive ova, and males evolved to produce small, cheap sperm. The splitting apart of the behavior of males and females stems from the fact that female DNA has a big commitment to and investment in each fertilized egg, while male DNA has nothing to lose and everything to gain by giving its host the tendency to fertilize every female in sight, then prowl around looking for the ones that aren't in sight. If this sounds like a shallow caricature, remember, we inherited many of our drives and tendencies from animals and prehistoric humans before concepts such as marriage and monogamy arrived. The DNA of males who mated with only one female had a terrible disadvantage. The other males who were going around spreading their DNA as widely as possible were going to have a lot more children. Without considering any other factors, males evolved to reproduce as much as possible. Remember, it's all about DNA. Females, on the other hand, having only a few chances per lifetime to pass on their DNA and many eager suitors, evolved to be a bit more selective. How did they select? A couple of factors were important. First, they wanted a male with good DNA, whatever that means. It might have meant a strong, healthy body, which would be passed on to the offspring and give them a better shot at survival. It might have meant having certain DNA in common with them, as evidenced by similar body features or behavior, since that doubled the chances that the offspring would carry that DNA. Second, they wanted a mate who would invest his time and resources in the children while they were immature and vulnerable, thus increasing their chance of survival. It wasn't essential, of course, that the genetic father be the one who sticks around and raises the kids. In fact, an ideal situation for a prehistoric female might have been to have a He-Man type with good genes as the biological father and a house husband type who's willing to raise the kids. Given the priorities of females, males evolved in one of two directions, either becoming stronger and more handsome or becoming a convincing potential husband and father. While both would benefit from having as much sex as possible, the He-Man could be a lot more overt about it, even physically overpowering unwilling females, since their offspring had a better chance of survival even without them sticking around. The house husband types, however, evolved to become good at finding a female who wasn't going to cheat on them. They might even prefer less attractive females, or at least females who are less attractive to the He-Man type, to increase their chances of being the biological father. They still wanted to have as much sex as possible, but needed to be a bit more surreptitious. The big, strong He-Men weren't going to take the competition lying down, and the females weren't particularly thrilled with having a mate who was already committed to someone else. Time for two reminders. First, I'm talking about general tendencies in evolution, not about specific individuals. People behave differently and are attracted to different types of mates in different circumstances. Secondly, all this happens unconsciously. This is not about thinking. All this clever, kludgy process of mate selection happens unconsciously. The result of the unconscious calculation is that you have feelings of attraction for someone. Of course, if having certain thoughts increased your chances of mating, evolution would have selected for your having those thoughts. There's nothing in the universe as complicated as this process of sexual selection, which has evolved over millions of generations to incorporate every kludge that came along. The eons pass, and the pivotal role of sex in evolution causes things to get more and more complicated and involved. These two roles, He-Man and house husband, split off into many sub-roles, with male dominance hierarchies, female territorial disputes, and all manner of deceit and subterfuge becoming more and more prevalent for one and only one reason. It works. The behaviors that evolved around sex up until the very recent past when memes appeared on the scene did so because that's what got DNA passed down. In the harsh reality of genetic evolution, there was no concern for love, sensitivity, or fairness. The only thing that mattered was how many children you had, children who themselves grew up to reproduce. Now, here's the next bombshell. A common paradigm people have about life places sex as a small, if confusing, part of a grand culture based on values, morals, traditions, and God-given rights. Viewed through mimetics, all values, morals, traditions, and ideas with respect to God and rights are the result of meme evolution. And meme evolution is guided by our genetic tendencies, which in turn evolved around sex. The male-dominated hierarchical system, sometimes called the patriarchy, is a perfect example. Some feminist writers have cautioned women against buying into this system, and with good reason. The whole thing evolved so that the DNA of males could be passed down most efficiently. Is that any way to design an economy? Why are men so obsessed with dominance relationships, with who's above and below them on the power ladder? The best theory is that it was an adaptation to establish which males had sexual rights to which women, without constantly fighting about it, which didn't do anybody any good. Because of that, males seem to have a sixth sense that tells them what their position is relative to other males in any situation. The typical female sense of status is based more on attractiveness or popularity than dominance. Most businesses, the government, the military, and even the Catholic Church are set up as overt hierarchies. It's explicitly clear who reports to whom and who takes and gives orders. On the surface of it, these organizational hierarchies now have little to do with access to females. but the behavior and feelings men have in them are still the same. Making the hierarchy explicit avoids many face-to-face battles for position. However, it can be extremely frustrating for men with evolved brains who want to rise in the hierarchy, to have access to more and better females, but who see no way to improve their position. But wait a minute. Don't some men and women like power for its own sake? Don't they enjoy the control it gives them over destiny, the freedom to live their lives, and, well, just the power rush? Yes, that's all true. But the reason that power is such a rush is that we've evolved to have wiring in our brains that make us crave that power. Through the course of evolution, the men who enjoyed and hungered for power, for a top rung in the dominance hierarchy, pushed harder for it and therefore got more mates. Not only did they get more mates, but they also got more resources to give their children, enhancing their chances of reproducing. The most unforgiving force in genetic evolution screened out those males who didn't enjoy power. They didn't reproduce nearly as much, their children didn't have as good a chance of reproducing, and their genes faded away as the genes responsible for the power lust grew more and more prevalent. Men don't consciously think, gee, I'd better seek and display power so I can manipulate women into mating with me. Evolution has made them seek and display power instinctively. Throughout history, while males have been pushing culture in the direction of expansion, conquest, and increased power, females have been the so-called civilizing force, striving for security and safety. These drives are direct offshoots of the different priorities of the male and female genes. Males' genes tend to win by encouraging their host to mate with as many females as possible, while females' genes tend to win by giving their host the tendency to create a safe and secure environment to raise the children. Why? Because males had relatively little investment of their time and energy in a particular fetus, while females couldn't produce more than one a year or so and needed to protect their genetic capital. Did males have an investment in any given child surviving to reproduce? You bet. Was their investment as great as a female's? Not if they were high enough on the dominance hierarchy that they could impregnate a whole bunch of women. And those men were the ones who passed down the most genes. So it fell to the females, in order to protect their investment, to set certain standards for acceptable male behavior. Because women's genes had more to gain by being picky about mates, evolution made women the ones who usually chose from among suitors. Men had to compete to be chosen. So women could afford to be selective, much more so than men. They could afford to put men through some tests to see if they were serious about the relationship. By holding out until a man invested a substantial amount of time and resources, they lessened the possibility that their suitor was merely toying with their affections. They increased the probability that the guy was indeed playing the husband-father role and not just looking for some cheap thrills. If all this sounds hopelessly cold and calculating, remember once again that this male testing is not necessarily conscious on the part of the female. Genes that favored this testing tendency in females got passed down successfully over genes that did not. The result is that it just feels right to get a certain degree of certainty about a man's intentions before mating. I don't want to give the impression that I could describe the sex roles of men and women accurately and completely, even if I devoted the whole book to it. The general roles of he-man, husband-father, and suitor-tester describe some of the basic ways men and women behave with each other. But in evolution, anything goes. In fact, we should expect certain individuals to evolve to exploit, manipulate, lie, cheat, and steal in their genes' unstoppable quest to reproduce themselves. One class of such manipulation is surreptitious mating. For males, this often takes the form of extramarital sex. Interestingly enough, there's not much genetic reason for females to get upset about this, other than the possibility that the man will fall in love with the other woman and leave the wife and family. For females, the cheating might have involved being secretly impregnated by a he-man with better genes while not letting the house husband find out. This is not nearly as big a win for the woman's genes as a man's cheating, since it only involves the potential slight improvement of the child's survival against the risk that the husband will leave, so we shouldn't expect the drive to be nearly as strong. The unfortunate conclusion is that the payoff, and hence the drive, is much greater for men cheating with other women. For them, every additional pregnancy is another potential gene-carrying child at virtually no cost to the father. Time out. Back up. How can I say that the whole point of cheating is to have more babies when we know people don't want to have babies as a result of affairs? Once again, the trick is to remember that there's a difference between our conscious thoughts today and the forces of natural selection on DNA in prehistoric times. The unconscious tendency to have affairs in certain circumstances is hardwired into people's minds as a result of evolution, as a result of the fact that our ancestors with those tendencies mated to have us. Regardless of today's morals, values, or thoughts, we're still stuck with that prehistoric programming that works by making us attracted to, infatuated with, fall in love with certain other people. We have incredibly strong sex drives as the result of natural selection. Once we evolved to have those strong sex drives, new kludgy uses were able to evolve on top of them. For instance, anthropological studies suggest that one main goal of female infidelity is not getting pregnant, but getting other favors, such as more meat for her kids, from the He-Man. Conversely, this is why the He-Man goes out hunting. Not because it's an efficient way to get protein, I mean, it isn't. Gathering is much more reliable. But because a big score lets him trade meat for sex all over the village. And then, of course, there's nothing to stop people from engaging in purely recreational sexual activity in their leisure time. Since natural selection evolved sex for reproduction to be so pleasurable, it makes sense that sex for its own sake would still be a favored activity as long as it didn't interfere with survival or reproduction. As the tactics and counter-tactics of mating strategies evolved, cheaters became better and better at cheating, and mates became better and better at detecting or preventing it. But the genetic payoff is so large that cheating remains a big factor in the way genes are passed down. Faking a role is another way of increasing one's chances of genetic payoff. It's tough to fake a He-Man role when there are more dominant men around because they will tend to put you back in your place quickly. But we could expect a man who quickly notices he's the most dominant male around to get tough to win genetically. Faking the husband-father role offers much more chance for creativity. The most common ruse for a husband is pretending he's not already married in order to acquire another mating opportunity. For a bachelor, the classic scam is promising eternal love and commitment, but leaving after a few romps in the hay. Of course, the women who evolve to be suspicious and discover such behavior have an advantage, so once again we can expect the strategies of cheaters and detectives to improve over the eons. This is why bird mating dances are often so long and drawn out, taxing both parties literally to exhaustion. The female bird knows, in the evolutionary sense, that no married male will go to that extreme for a one-night stand at the risk of his real family elsewhere, so she makes him prove he's really single by demanding every ounce of energy he's got to give. If everyone had exactly the same mating strategy, the less attractive people would always lose out. They would never mate. So some suitors evolved niche strategies that might attract fewer potential mates, but mates whom there was less competition for. They got a larger market share of a smaller market, but overall the niche strategy made it more likely for their DNA to be passed on. Niche mating strategies are why we have different strokes for different folks. While the bulk of men pursue women under 30, who genetically have the most childbearing value, some men prefer older women. While most people are attracted to those with similar facial features, indicating similar DNA, some pursue exotic-looking mates. While most females test suitors before having sex with them, some are extremely promiscuous, perhaps resulting in the offspring getting at least some resources from a slew of potential fathers. Niche mating strategies are a shotgun approach, and the goal is to scatter the DNA as widely as possible. One way for DNA to increase its chances of winning in the human reproduction game, aside from doing everything possible to get its own host to reproduce, is to make it more difficult for others to reproduce. In the pre-meme days, powerful males could physically intimidate other males and keep many females for themselves. Males lower on the dominance ladder would be most likely to pass on their DNA by pretending to respect the sanctity of the dominant male's harem, but secretly taking advantage of whatever mating opportunities they could find. Studies show chimpanzees engaging in just this behavior. When memes arrived on the scene, it became in the genetic interest of males to spread memes that would decrease the likelihood of other males mating. It was in the interest of females' DNA to spread memes promoting good behavior in their suitors. It was in the interest of grandparents to spread memes that would result in the successful rearing of their grandchildren. Thus were born the concepts of sexual mores. Sexual mores are rules of the game, so to speak. They are strategy memes saying, "Don't do this thing you have a desire for." They keep you from mating with some class of potential mate. People get programmed with them as they're being raised. The interesting thing about sexual mores is that when you get programmed with one, you may actually be behaving counter to the interest of your own selfish DNA. It's easy to tell what your DNA wants. Just notice who you're sexually attracted to. That's a good indication that, genetically, mating with that person would be useful in passing down your DNA. Some of the first known sexual prohibitions, those in the Ten Commandments, fit right into this model. Two of the commandments forbid a man having sex with or even coveting another man's wife. Men who put that big investment into a home and family only to become cuckolded, referring to the cuckoo bird, which manipulates other birds into raising its young, those men lose big in the evolutionary game, and so might be expected to spread memes discouraging other men from having affairs with their wives. But following sexual mores makes you behave in the interest of everyone else's DNA, not your own. So the optimal selfish gene strategy, before people became conscious and had the possibility of a life about something other than spreading their DNA, was to participate in spreading mores, but to secretly ignore them whenever an opportunity arose to mate counter to them. That is the evolutionary explanation for hypocrisy. We should expect to see the most hypocrisy around sex, since it's simultaneously in everyone's DNA's advantage, both to spread anti-sex memes and to selfishly ignore them. Although sometimes it seems like men and women are from different planets, given how we often have trouble comprehending each other, the basic differences all come from this battle of the sexes I've just talked about. Men generally tend to be interested in power and their place in the hierarchy, in seizing opportunities for sex as quickly and effectively as possible. Generally, they are most attracted to women who have the most reproductive potential, who are young and healthy. Typically, they are possessive of their women, guarding against being cuckolded. Women, generally, tend to value security, commitment, and men who are willing to invest in them. As a rule, they are most attracted to two types of men, the strong and powerful, and the committed and generous. Generally, they guard against their man being stolen away by another woman and are on the lookout for any evidence that a man may be losing interest and do anything possible to correct the situation. Ever wonder why men tend to sneak peeks at attractive women? It was evolutionarily important for them to size up and react to mating opportunities quickly. For the same reason, men get quickly aroused by visual stimuli, which is why today pornography is much more popular with men than with women. Men naturally try to impress women with their strength and power, and it works. Ever wonder why a woman gets upset if a man doesn't call her for a week? To her, it endangers the safety and security of the day-to-day relationship that she has been genetically bred to crave, and her defense mechanisms kick into action. Even if she is mature and confident, she's still likely to feel upset. It's a powerful, primal feeling. Women naturally test men to make sure they're really committed and not just faking it, and it works. Over the last few centuries, these sex roles have been affected greatly by meme evolution. And so we find men and women being less successful at reproducing, more frustrated in their relationships, and more confused as the primitive societies we evolved to live in have been supplanted by incredibly complicated and powerful cultural forces. But these drives we've been bred with are still with us, and mind viruses take advantage of them. They hook us. Different cultures today have evolved different sets of sexual mores, resulting in differences in male and female behavior. In Sweden, a social democracy where women have great economic independence, we see a high degree of sexual freedom among women. Without needing to depend on men for their security, Swedish women need not be concerned so much with testing potential mates for commitment and generosity. The result is greater promiscuity among women. A study showed Swedish men prize a potential mate's virginity very little compared with other cultures. Swedish men, in turn, are among the least violent of any culture. With women more available, men need not engage in the violent, risky he-man behavior that comes from a genetic drive to rise in the hierarchy and therefore have greater access to women. Harsh punishment for violent crime isn't necessary. In sexually strict Saudi Arabia, we see the opposite. Women are highly dependent on men for economic security. Access to sex is greatly restricted for Saudi women. Men prize virginity in their potential mates. Violence is high, an artifact of prehistoric times when engaging in such behavior increased a man's chances of mating, and punishment for violent crime is severe in reaction to that. Access to sex is the driving force behind many aspects of culture. Through a chain of cause and effect, the availability of females for men to mate with can shape prevailing mores, the amount of violence, and the laws and punishment of a culture. There's been a shift in sexual mores in the United States from the free love era of the 60s, when a baby boom surplus of young women did their own thing sexually, to the AIDS-fearful 90s, when young women were admonished to just say no and abstain from sex. This shift has been accompanied by an increase in violent crime among men, as would be predicted by this model. Sexual reproduction is the number one force behind genetic evolution. We evolved instincts and tendencies that supported maximum success in mating back before our culture started evolving. Now here we are in the 21st century and still hardwired for caveman days. No wonder the self-help section in the bookstore is overflowing with titles. All these instincts and drives evolved to increase the likelihood of women getting pregnant and having babies. But the millions of years of genetic evolution that produced these instincts did not count on our figuring out that we could have sex and not get pregnant. We've thrown a huge monkey wrench, or a rubber sheath, into the genetic works. We've figured out how to have sex without having babies, and as a result, the act of mating is no longer the genetic prize it was for millions of years. Our instincts still think mating equals reproduction, and that's why our sex drives are still so strong. But now everything has changed. What really benefits our selfish DNA now is the baby-making drive, choosing to have a baby. In future generations, through genetic evolution, choosing to have babies will become more and more compelling. If we were really responsible about use of birth control and never having unplanned pregnancies, the now useless sex drive would even atrophy. I wouldn't count on it, though. Natural selection works quickly to punish lack of reproduction. With governments now guaranteeing the health and well-being of all children, we should expect that segment of the population to grow who doesn't use birth control. That includes people who think they have good genes and want to reproduce them, but it also includes the irresponsible and the uneducated. And some religions forbid birth control, a genetically winning strategy. Like it or not, we only live a few years, and the DNA of those of us who have a tendency not to have children will soon die out. Those of us who only have a few children will be swamped by those who have many. So if we were living unconsciously, our drives would direct our behavior to maximize our DNA's chance of spreading. Living with the programming of society's mores, we don't even get that. What about those of us who don't have children? What about homosexuals? How can homosexuality survive natural selection? That is one of the toughest questions evolutionary biologists have had to face in applying Darwinism to human beings. One theory is simply that evolution's in a state of flux right now. As memes have recently become more important than genes, our DNA hasn't yet caught up. If this is the case, it will certainly catch up soon, and we'd expect to see higher birth rates over most of the population. Another possibility is that those of us who don't have children have become, in effect, genetic slaves of those of us who do. The childbearers have spread the right combination of memes, infected us with the right viruses of the mind, to keep us happily working to make the world a better place for their children. That's one possibility if we look at life from the point